You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 1st, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matthew Dalek, author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. And later in the show, journalist Maura Lavelle on Greece and the elections there. Meanwhile, the House overwhelmingly passes the McCarthy-Biden debt ceiling bill. It goes to the Senate now. Some of the concessions, you know, more money for the military, more work requirements for needy people on food stamps, clawback of IRS enforcement. I mean, it's a win for Republicans for just no reason. And better news, happy Pride Month, everybody. Prosecutors say Trump recorded a crucial conversation about classified documents in 2021. Probably the AI. AI? Ever heard of it? Excuse me. There's no evidence that that is me. Meanwhile, DeSantis travels to Iowa, starts attacking Trump on spending and decorum. He still refused to mention Trump by name in front of voters, says the New York Times. He only attacked him to reporters afterwards. This guy is so bad at this.
Juiceless.
He has an habit. Speaking of future failed presidential candidates, Mike Pence set to announce next week. Oklahoma Supreme Court strikes down two anti-abortion laws for their exceptions being too narrow, but the broader ban still in place in the state. In Tennessee, a woman denied an emergency abortion for an ectopic pregnancy, life-threatening, and she was forced to get a hysterectomy at age 32 and is now infertile. Florida businesses striking over DeSantis' immigration crackdown. The only group he might listen to on that front. A revised DACA program headed back to the federal judge who previously deemed it illegal or struck it down. LGBTQ activists in Turkey fearful of Erdogan further cementing his grip on power as anti-gay rhetoric ramps up. The FTC fines Amazon for violating child privacy with its Alexa technology. And lastly, Project Veritas suing its founder, James O'Keefe, for abusing employees and misusing funds. Really, just couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Can't believe Project Veritas is going woke.
I mean, aren't they? It's in the name. Veritas? Truth? Doesn't sound like that here. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. We have a great show for you. It's an Majority Report Thursday. Hello to my friends Matt, Bradley, and Dorsey in studio today. So, no Sam, but
full house.
We still have technically the four-person full house. Let's get right into it because we have two great interviews for you today. I already spoke actually to Maura. We pre-recorded the interview on the elections in Greece and just, you know, troubling trends about anti-immigrant sentiment broadly in Europe and the inability of the left to beat back right-wing efforts on that front. But other immensely concerning developments happening in Georgia. So three Stop Cop City activists have been arrested in Georgia. I mean, this is a part of a larger effort to crack down on anybody opposing the construction of Cop City, which is the massive compound in a forest in Georgia that activists, environmental activists, want to be protected, let alone the clearly disturbing trend of giving police more and more infrastructure and power, because these are the kinds of things that they do with it here. They have cracked down on activists, arrest dozens of them. I mean, they killed a forest offender named Tortuguita. I guess there's been, yeah, like over 40 activists facing domestic terror charges on trumped up claims by the police. But the recent incredibly concerning development here is that three activists, as I mentioned, have been arrested after a SWAT team raided the home where the organizers were, and they're charging them, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation working with Atlanta police, with money laundering and charity fraud. And in this instance, these activists were working with the Atlanta Solidarity Fund, which is essentially a part of a nonprofit that helps raise money for bail funds. And bail funds, not illegal last time I checked in this country. Not in the slightest. But when you're in a fascist police state, these are the kinds of charges that are going to be brought against protesters, particularly if you're on the left. So Brian Kemp released a statement about this. He issued a press release here, if we have that. The governor of Georgia. This was his description of how his administration is cracking down on the Cop City forest protectors. Let's put up this. Yeah. For months, law enforcement on the state and local level have worked diligently to secure the site of the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center in the face of violence from mostly out-of-state activists. Now, I want you to pay attention to that phrase, because that was very similar language used in the civil rights movement to describe people coming in and protesting Jim Crow.
And let's be very clear about, like, local control of government and to the extent that's at stake here. First of all, every corporation, including, like, what did you say, the Falcons or the...
Yes, the owner of the Falcons, Arthur Blank, is funding this.
Norfolk Southern, the railroad behind the East Palestine crash, is funding this. So you want to talk about, like, outside agitation. Like, that's probably where I would start with this.
It's a great point. Money in that instance really pales in comparison to the cobbling together of bail funds for these protesters.
And the other point to make is, like, if really, like, local control is your concern, this issue could be very easily solved by throwing it to a referendum.
But they're terrified to do that.
Instead, we're going in there like it's Fallujah. And we're also using, like, basically, like, the tactics the FBI used against different sort of liberation movements, like Black Panthers, American Indian movement, to basically legally tie up anybody who's as not only to, like, ruin their lives and take them out of the paint, but also send a message to the movement.
Chilling effect.
General. Yeah, so you could do this with democracy. They're using cops.
He continues. After calling them in the face of violence from another point, the violence came from the cops who murdered Tortuguita. For months, law enforcement on the state and local level have worked diligently to secure the site of the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center in the face of violence from mostly out of state activists. Would it matter if
take a vote then, Brian?
Yeah. See, if you want it just to be left to the state voters, we can make that happen. They came to harass police officers and civilians, choosing destruction over legitimate protests. The destruction, this is me speaking now, is what's happening to the land there. And that's what environmental activists are concerned about. Thanks to our brave law enforcement, many of them have already been arrested. And today we're proud to share those who back their illegal actions are also under arrest and will face justice. These criminals facilitated and encouraged domestic terrorism with no regard for others. Watching as communities face the destructive consequences of their actions. What communities?
It is regard for others and the communities. Like, if you, again, All this is a bluff. If you think the communities are so supportive of Cop City, take a referendum on it.
Here in Georgia, we do not allow that to happen. Today's announcement is a reminder that we will track down every member of a criminal organization, from violent foot soldiers to their uncaring leaders. We will not rest until they are arrested, tried, and face punishment. Again, this is just fascist insanity.
Yeah.
And then he thanks all the cops and other people working on this front. Rest assured, if you endanger the people of Georgia, law enforcement like them will ensure you face with justice. The person who died in this instance was Tortuguita, who cops seemingly, based on, you know, again, allegedly what we know now, are completely being untruthful about the circumstances surrounding their death. There is a person who actually was harmed in this instance, and that was Tortuguita. Not the, I don't know, communities that he's referencing. What is it, the donut-eating community? I don't really give a crap about the foot soldier for fascism here, because the implications for not just this situation, but for environmental activism in particular, more broadly, I mean, they're massive. These are the kinds of tactics that they're going to be copy-pasted when there are other environmental actions throughout the country. This is a test run, as was DAPL, as was the, I mean, pipeline protests, I'm forgetting in Washington the exact name of that one. But some of the tactics that were used against activists in that way, like, they are trying to create a blueprint for fascism to make sure that protests against these, the kind of destruction that actually matters, are as cracked down upon as possible. And again, like, just the second step of going after the people raising money to get these forest protectors out of prison. It's just astounding to me.
Yeah, and I'll say this. This is on, at this point, Democrats, I think. We need a lot more forceful from, like, I mean, I think ACLU is going to be on this, but, like, politicians, particularly anyone who wore a kente cloth during the George Floyd protests, this is absolutely the moment to be extremely, and they're not. Like, I mean, maybe I've missed certain things Stacey Abrams has said or Warnock said, but, like, or Ossoff, like, mm-hmm. But, like, this is, I think that tepidness is allowing this sort of response. And I'm sorry, like, it's great to have an organization that can, like, agitate to make sure, like, mail-in votes are still counted. But this is, like, a acute emergency for democracy right now. And, like, there needs to be way more alarm on the part of the party that is supposedly, you know, nominally representing democracy.
We had a caller call in last week, and I wrote it down in my notes. Just wanted to make sure I touched on it here, too, because, like, this is not just happening, too, with environmental activism. In Asheville, the caller wrote in and spoke about how the city in that instance is bringing charges against activists who were helping out the houseless in Asheville on felony littering charges. Felony littering charges. So they'll bring whatever they can. They'll bring the full force of the law down on people fighting for environmental activism, for the rights of homeless people in this country, for anybody that challenges the churn of power and capital in the country. That's it. And for everybody else, hey, free pass. So,
yeah, what you're seeing is the American sort of state, corporations included, basically preparing for, okay, we got sort of shown up by the George Floyd protests. We need to prepare cops for the next one of those. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's what we're seeing there. So there's all these folks who are actually saying, like, the George Floyd protests was like the Democratic Party burning down cities. They're actually doing the work of, like, the pro-cop Democrats right now in helping push basically things like Cop City and other policies.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking.
The pray during the break.
Yeah. It's time for us to hold hands and sing to God. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Matthew Dalek. are back, and we are joined now by Matthew Dalek, a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management and author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me on.
For sure. So this topic is endlessly fascinating to me. I love historicizing the extremism of the Republican Party. It's just really important for people to know it's not just, you know, the appearance of Orange Bad Man, but a continuation of a decades-long project from a lot of different groups, notably the John Birch Society. And we had Edward Miller on, I think, 2 years ago to talk about this very topic.
Okay.
But it's it's just, I can't get enough of it. So so for people,
here we are.
So yeah. Here we are, and your book is excellent, and we'll link to it in the description so people can check it out. But for people that might not know, what is the John Birch Society?
Yeah, so the John Birch Society was a group, a grassroots activist group from the 1960s. It was organized all over the country. 60 to 100,000 members, mostly white, mostly Christian, many of them upwardly mobile members. And the group, at least the headquarters, argued that there was an internal communist conspiracy, basically that there was a threat within the United States. It was the greatest threat to the country, and it was a communist inspired. And so the Birchers' goal essentially was to try to root out that threat by educating the American people about the menace in their hometowns.
I want to return to the anti-communism, which is super important to understand. But when you describe them as, you know, Christian, white, and upwardly mobile, it reminds me of the January Sixers, where there was like a small kind of bump in the news cycle where people were saying, like, you know, the January 6th rioters, they're just misled, they don't have a ton of like financial means and stuff, and people looked into some of their class background, and a lot of them are, you know, upper middle class small business owners with backyard like pools and things like that in different pockets of the country, and and that seems to be very similar to the people that, you know, you reference here or talk about.
Yeah. Well, I actually end the book with January 6th, essentially. And, you know, you never want to take the echoes or the parallels too far. But absolutely, there are, you know, look, one of the things I argue is that the Birch Society helped show the far right and subsequent generations of far right activists how to forge a primarily white Christian cross-class alliance, including the super wealthy, which is how the Birchers started, a handful of extremely wealthy, mostly businessmen, a lot of upperly mobile professionals, doctors, engineers, you know, with some echoes of the January 6th types, ex-military, and then also some white working class of folks as well later in the decade, I think, primarily.
So then to touch there on the anti-communism, how did the John Birch Society get established in the midst of the anti-communist hysteria? And how did they compare to, say, you know, the McCarthyist, more mainstream anti-communism that we also saw was incredibly destructive?
Well, look, the McCarthy, Joe McCarthy was actually one of the heroes to a lot of Birchers. And what's a little ironic is that the Birch Society, which was founded in 1958, was actually founded, you know, in the kind of middle of the Cold War, but not in the early 50s or late 40s, right? It was, you know, I wouldn't say that it wasn't quite the time for a detente, but they did come after McCarthy. And the Birch founders looked at Joe McCarthy and other conservative heroes, anti-New Deal, hardline anti-communist heroes, and they argued that they had been sidelined, right? That they had been, you know, as Robert Welch, the founder, once wrote, he argued that Bob Taft, a senator from Ohio, who was another hero, that he may have been killed by a radium tube that had been implanted in his Senate seat and that had caused the cancer that had murdered him. So you know, you see the, not just the conspiracy theories, but you see the martyrs. And so they very much operate. And one of the key distinctions between anti-communists like John Kennedy or Dwight Eisenhower and the Birchers is that the Birchers saw the greatest threat as fellow Americans, right? It was coming from within. And basically branding a lot of Americans, including at times people like Eisenhower and media figures, a communist, right? Traitors to the country, that they had betrayed the Constitution. I mean, that was why the campaign to impeach Earl Warren resonated with a subset of Americans, because, you know, the argument was that Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, had aided and abetted the communists with a variety of his decisions. And so, you know, there was a legacy predating 1958, predating the 60s, in which they had these martyrs. They picked up on the martyrdom and they looked at the enemy within. And that distinguished them, at least in part. They also had other ideas, too, that I argue that distinguished them from more mainstream conservatives.
Can you expand on the, going after Warren and trying to impeach the Chief Justice there? Because obviously it's a great connection to draw where this like conservative far right movement goes makes overhauling the Supreme Court a major objective. And you can obviously see the shadows of that today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the time, you know, now impeaching a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you know, impeachment doesn't sound so radical, right? We've been through impeachments, right, with presidents. But at the time, in the early 60s, the idea that you were going to impeach a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which, you know, was constitutional, but it was still seen as a, by most people, as a radical step. It wasn't really done. And then of all people, they're targeting Warren. And Warren was seen, first of all, former Republican governor of California, appointed by, I believe, by Eisenhower, and really an emblem of the establishment, and seen as the architect of a number of great liberal decisions, including most notably Brown versus Board of Education, desegregating the schools, and other decisions too, like putting a ban on prayer in public schools or affording rights to criminal defendants. Well, to many Birchers, these decisions, Brown most notably, but others too, was a pattern of unconstitutional pro-communist state expansion, right? Giving the federal Leviathan more and more power to trample on what they saw as individual liberties. And so the Birchers put up billboards all over the country that became actually iconic. You could see them, you know, driving, going to upstate, wherever you were going. And they were hard to miss. And so even though a majority of the country did not want to impeach Earl Warren and thought it was sort of absurd, there was a subset who were mobilized by this idea and really impassionate about it, to the point they used their own money in some cases to erect these billboards. So you see how a single issue sort of packaged in a powerful way can mobilize people even if it doesn't succeed.
And it packages the anti-communist fears with racism and fears of change, right? Which leads to levels of conspiracy, I would imagine, that like become the hallmark of the John Birch Society and the Birchers. Is that fair?
Yeah. Well, so yeah, the Birchers certainly engaged in a number of conspiracies, and one of their hallmarks, as you say, was the conspiracism. There was also a more explicit racism. Not all Birchers, I don't think, were racist, but there were a good number who were, and who were also anti-Semitic. There was an argument among Birchers. They wanted to essentially repeal the New Deal, right? They wanted to, which is part of the reason they loathed Dwight Eisenhower. They saw him as accepting the New Deal. They wanted to repeal the New Deal, and they opposed the entire post-World War II international order. They, one of their other slogans was get the U.S. out of the United Nations. And one of their insights, I think, was that they were able, by branding all of these issues as communist, as pro-communist, they were able to define the enemy as they saw it, with a real epithet, but apply it to many different areas of American life, including also, I should mention, what we know today as these hardline culture wars, sort of banning books, putting pro-Americanist literature in schools and libraries. So they were early adopters. And again, you know, by saying they're all communist dominated, they're all un-American, they were able to mobilize a good number of people in support of all these causes.
Can you talk about the anti-democracy element there, of how Bircher's, you know, we can also make a connection, like it's this imposition of fundamentalist Christianity and a democracy. They might call it a democracy, but it isn't really that, right? Or it's about rights for certain people to impose on others.
So another slogan they had was, we're a republic, not a democracy. Let's keep it that way. So they were very explicit that they didn't want democracy. Robert Welch, I believe, one of the founder of the movement, he said that democracy was tyranny of the mob. So what did they mean? Well, it meant different things to different people. For some, I think it did mean imposing a kind of Christian moral order, as they defined it, on the rest of the country. To others, it meant that majority rule trampled, again, as they saw it, on the rights of states and individuals to live their lives free of federal harassment and interference. And so democracy, they argued, essentially was contrary to the Constitution, contrary to the things that made America great, and that therefore it had to be opposed. So they were anti-majoritarian and very explicitly so. And they made no kind of bones about it. Although I would say one big difference between then and now is that you didn't see the kind of election denialism among the Birchers back then as we see today, for I think various reasons, but that's one distinction. But yeah, they didn't like democracy.
It's a distinction, but it's also, you can describe it as an evolution, right? Where it fits into the current context, but it's kind of a very similar framework.
Yeah. Yes. And if you're going to argue, as some Birchers did, that Dwight Eisenhower was an agent of the communist conspiracy, or that Chief Justice Earl Warren was pro-communist, or many other, you know, pretty moderate liberals and conservatives even were communists, well, you're really saying that, you know, they're not legitimate, right? That they're foreign agents or foreign directed agents. That's also, by the way, what they did with the civil rights movement. They called it communist dominated, right? That it wasn't an organic struggle to promote African-American aspirations, social justice and civil rights. It was actually Kremlin directed. And so there is a way in which they delegitimized a lot of democratically elected individuals and figures, or appointed individuals and figures, and also a grassroots democratic movements for racial equality.
The notion of political actors being puppets of foreign forces is also something I'd love to explore, because you touch on the anti-Semitism of it. We hear about globalists all the time on this program. We know what that means. It means the Jews, or, you know, very well, you know, or wealthy Jews, the Jews. Mm-hmm. I don't even need to parse it. Yeah. So, I mean, how much of that, too, can you trace back to a lot of these conspiracies?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I argue is that the conspiracy theories of the Birchers, they do act as a kind of permission slip for a lot of racists and anti-Semites in particular, in part because a lot of as one Anti-Defamation League operative said after Kennedy was killed, that a lot of conspiracy theorists are going to blame the communists for Kennedy's death, and then they're going to add the usual Jewish Philip to the conspiracy. And I think it's an insight that applies to a lot of these conspiracy theories, right? that something is wrong, you know, either inside or outside the country. There is a cabal of these elites. They're unseen in a way, or their wealth is unseen, and they are manipulating, you know, kind of traditional American ideas, values, and people. And so, you know, what you have, what I try to document in the book, and I wasn't going into the research knowing what I would find, but what I do try to document, and clearly not every member of the Birch Society was anti-Semitic, but there were a lot of them. And the Birchers at times try to police their ranks of anti-Semites, but there were so many of them, it was very hard for them to do. And I think as the 60s wore on, they attracted more and more anti-Semites to the ranks, became even more radical. And just a last quick point, I think in terms of today, I do see MAGA and Trump in some ways descending and becoming more radical themselves, because the conspiracy theories almost set people, you know, if a conspiracy theory helps to define a movement, it helps set people on a, I think, a more radical path. And the Birchers kind of follow that trajectory to some extent.
And, you know, you mentioned Trump there, but now I'm just curious, as, you know, these Bircher chapters get set up throughout the country and perhaps their kind of way of thinking becomes a little bit more widespread, like as we move into the 60s and beyond, what candidates in the modern Republican Party or from that period on do you see as most aligned with birtherism, you know, Trump maybe not included because you just used that example?
Yeah. You mean post-60s?
Yes, yes.
Post-60s. Well, I do go through in the last third of the book, sort of bringing us from the 1970s to the present. I think there are a number of figures, many of whom run for president. People like John Schmitz and Tom Anderson. Schmitz was actually a member of Congress. They ran for president. They're both Birchers and ran for president on a third party American party ticket in 1972. Pat Buchanan in the 1990s is a popular analogy, but I think, and actually, you know, interestingly, not only did Buchanan pick up on some of the ideas, some of the isolationism of the Birch Society, I think some of the anti-Semitism and concerns about sovereignty. But actually in 2000, this is little remembered, but he picked a vice presidential nominee or candidate who was actually in 2000 a national spokeswoman for the Birch Society at the time, because it still existed then and still does today. So his running mate was a card-carrying Bircher. People like Ron Paul. You know, Ron Paul is, I think, an important figure. He actually, you know, often talks about his great friendship with Larry McDonald, who was a leader of the Birch Society in the late 70s, in the 70s and early 80s. But also how, you know, the Birch Society really are constitutionalists, according to Paul. And so, and some of the conspiracy theories, concerns about sovereignty, isolationism or anti-interventionism, the shrinking, the idea of shrinking the federal government, you know, down to this pre-New Deal era. Those ideas, I think Paul, you know, I don't know if he appropriates directly, but he certainly, you know, gets some ideological inspiration from the Birchers. Those are a few, but there are many, you know, there are others too, including Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann and others.
Lastly, another thing that really strikes me is the way that these chapters were set up and activated these groups on a local level. That's something I think we're seeing now with school boards, where if you can activate them at your John Birch Society chapter, they're going to be voting in every election, and they're going to be super involved. Like, that is key to understanding the modern Republican Party, too.
Yeah, and one of the things I argue is that 60 to 100,000 incredibly passionate and well-funded people with a devoted to a cause can have a greater impact than maybe millions of voters who just turn out at election time, because they can protest, they can picket, they can push issues onto the agenda, they can take over a PTA or a school board, or maybe create a controversy about what books are on the shelf library. There's a kind of superpower almost that they wield. And they do it, as you point out, really at the local level, in this case chapters, And it is, I think, similar to the outsized impact that we're seeing from, say, groups like Moms for Liberty, right, who are today, who, you know, a handful of individuals can set in motion a process where a book gets taken off, let's say, a school library, and then it gets vetted and reviewed, and maybe it gets put back on or not. So that dynamic, I think, it shows the power of grassroots local activism and how it's important also to have counteracting forces, both grassroots and institutional, that are, you know, in a way defending democracy and pluralism and other values that to a lot of Americans, the United States stands for.
Well, everyone should check out this book, learn more about the John Birch Society. It's very helpful to being a good opponent of the Republican Party and MAGA and Trumpism and all that today. Matthew Dalek, author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right, will put a link to the book in the description wherever you're listening to or watching this and at majority.fm. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Emma, thank you for having me on. It was great.
For sure. Yes, it was. I agree. So, all right, guys, we're going to take a quick break, and then you will be hearing our interview with Maura Lavelle on the elections in Greece and what's really, you know, going on over there. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by Maura Lavelle, independent reporter covering Greece, whose piece in Jacobin is entitled, Greece's Election Offers Little Hope for an End to Austerity. Maura, thanks so much for coming on. There you are. We have you right there. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So we'll link to your piece in the description so people can read it, but just if you could give us a quick rundown of the elections and where we stand right now, because there was a round, but it seems like, or it appears, in the next few weeks, there's going to be another round of elections. Just from a big picture view, if you could explain that to our audience and why that's the case, that another round is happening so soon.
Yes. So Greece had one round of elections, as you said, on May 21st, the last Sunday, but essentially no party was able to get large enough of a majority to be able to win the parliament. And then none of them were willing to form a coalition with each other. So essentially it was hung parliament, and so they will go to a second round of elections towards the end of June.
And in terms of why those coalitions were unable to be formed, if you could break that down for our audience.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, it's definitely a game of who wants to have control of parliament. You had there's several left parties, and though the largest leftist party, Syriza, was willing at least to form coalitions with the other parties, the two sort of following parties expressed repeatedly that they had no interest in forming a coalition due to political differences on certain policies, but also, as we'll talk about a bit later, blame over how Syriza handled austerity and the crisis here in Greece in the 2015. The party that won, go ahead.
No. Just to stop you there for a sec, like my recollection from the time, and again, this is just from an American perspective, was that Syriza was presented as a left-wing populist party. And yet, obviously, as you write about in your piece, there have been some disappointments on that front. But that was like my initial remembering of who they were from, you know, a U.S. perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's completely correct, right? When they first came onto the scene, they were the Alliance of Radical Change, poor translation there, but essentially that. And yeah, it was this party that really gained a lot of popularity after the crisis, the economic crisis, first hit Greece in, say, 2008. So the party that had been the stalwart left party, PASOK, kind of collapsed. And then New Democracy was the right-wing party. Both of them were critiqued with handling austerity and essentially crushing the Greek population with austerity measures. And so from this, Syriza comes onto the scene. And they were elected in 2015, and they had this rhetoric that they were going to be the change that Greece needed, and they were going to help Greece get out from under the thumb of the creditors, and they were going to essentially be this change that Greeks were thirsting for. But then, for a multitude of reasons, they weren't able to bring this change. They were just as beholden, if not more beholden, to the Troika, the creditors, than previous governments. And there was this famous referendum where they asked the Greek public if, essentially, if they wanted to go along with certain economic reforms as laid out, and the Greek public voted no, and then Syriza capitulated, essentially. And so this, paired with many other things, was a major source of disappointment and continues to hang over Syriza. So despite the campaign and the election now, this is very much a miasma on their name that they cannot shake off. And they lost a lot of people in this process, too, of those who had been pushing Syriza farther to the left, left the party at that point. And what I wrote about in this Jacobin piece is that essentially Syriza and all of the other left parties in Greece right now, from what voters were telling me and what political analysts were telling me, is that they just don't have a clear message for voters. What they're arguing is that we are not the right-wing party, New Democracy, which we can talk about in a bit, why people really don't want them. But there wasn't a concrete alternative, right? Like the campaign slogans of Syriza and other leftist parties were about change and a rupture in the system, but they didn't have any super clear policy proposals and certainly no clear rhetoric to back that up. And I think all the parties across the left sort of had this issue of there wasn't something they could argue for. They could only argue against. And there were so many of them that what we saw happen in the election is the left votes were completely splintered among these parties. Syriza lost like 600,000 votes from the previous elections 4 years ago. And the right-wing party, New Democracy, gained some votes, which was enough for them to come out ahead, but not have enough of a percentage to get the parliament unilaterally.
So for the New Democracy Party, the right-wing party here, what parties are they attempting to form coalitions with? I mean, not successfully so far. And what are really the major platform or planks of what they are proposing for Greece? Because the prime minister, right, is of this right-wing party and has been in power for a few years at this point. What have been like the major focuses of both his party and also what are some of the coalitions that they're trying to cobble together in this way?
Mm-hmm. So I will say New Democracy is not trying to form any coalition at all. They have no desire. It's a mess because they have the obligation theoretically to, but they have rejected that. Because in the second round of elections that we will go to at the end of June, the rules change. So it's not just that you need you don't win by a simple majority. Essentially, whichever party has the highest percentage of votes in the second round will get a cushion of extra seats, up to 50 extra seats in the parliament, so that it's a more theoretically stable parliament and you win more easily. And they have their eyes set on this 100%. They know that if they get the extra seats, they can completely win the parliament. They can have 2/3 of the parliament with this cushion. So a coalition is of no interest to them. They don't need it. But I think it's an interesting question. What was their argument? What was their platform? And their platform prior to the election was one of economic stability. There was the billboards all over Athens were arguing that we're moving forward with stability, and we're going to, you know, bring security to Greece. And it taps into this very real need that Greeks have for some security and stability right. in their lives. And Mitsotakis, as the prime minister, has really tried to make his name on restabilizing Greece's economy after the crisis. And, you know, they talk a lot about different indicators of how foreign investments rose and the economy is, you know, growing at twice the Eurozone average, and that they have exited the supervision and the controls that were placed over Greece by the creditors. They've now exited this surveillance. So they talk about this a lot, but these markers of economic stability are questionable right. in many different ways. I mean, the GDP is growing, but from what base when you're coming out of such a crisis? And I think the most basic way to explain it is that for your everyday Greek person, this foreign investment or whatever, it means nothing for them. The inflation is through the roof. People cannot pay their bills. Rents are soaring. Unemployment is still super high. I mean, it's not as high as it was at the height of the crisis, but it's the highest that is in Europe. And there's a real cost of living crisis. And so I think, yeah, this platform of we're going to bring Greece stability, it speaks to people because they want it. And they have some indicators they can argue that they have achieved economic stability for Greece. But it's right. is really debatable what that means for the average Greek person.
So, I mean, that means that it was pretty incumbent on the left-wing parties to provide an alternate vision in that way. And based on what you're telling me, that seems to have been quite a failure on that front, which is a broader problem, I think, for a lot of leftist parties throughout the world. Could you also just give our audience a greater understanding of what conditions under austerity over the past so many years have been like in Greece, leading them to a political moment where, from what you're telling me, it seems like there's a lot of disillusionment with options and with a way out of the crippling economic conditions imposed on Greece over, you know, the past decade plus.
Mm-hmm. I mean, austerity sort of has its fingers in every part of Greek life at this point, in that there are demands made by the creditors for the government to cut money from here, here, and here. And it's something that comes up constantly. For example, when COVID-19 hit Europe, Greece immediately went into a super harsh lockdown because it was known and very clear to everyone that if and when COVID hit the hospitals, it would be a catastrophe because the hospitals had been bankrupt by austerity measures for decades. And so there was a super harsh lockdown, which was lifted and reinstated and lifted and reinstated. And of course, eventually COVID did make it to the hospitals. And of course, they were entirely overburdened and the death rate was incredibly high. You also see austerity and the impact of it in this train crash that happened in Greece at the very end of February. There was this train crash where a passenger train collided head-on with a freight train. And it was the deadliest crash in Greece. 57 people died. Many of them were students. And people quickly became enraged because it quickly became clear that the reasons the trains crashed were systemic, that the signaling systems were just not operative, and they weren't operative because despite the fact that workers and the board that oversees train safety, everyone had pointed out to the fact that these signal operating systems were not working, were not up to par, and investment was just never made. And why was investment never made? Because there wasn't money, and because of austerity measures, which also led to the train systems being privatized. So it's this sort of thing of it's every part of public life has been sort of, yeah, dictated and controlled by austerity. And it seems that every crisis that happens has some impact, or some of it is dictated at least partially by the fact that things are underfunded, and then there's a corruption that comes from austerity measures. I mean, I could go on. There was also fires a few years ago on this island of Evia, and it was the fires raged and burnt like a third of the island, and it became clear again in the aftermath of this horrible tragedy that part of the problem was that the fire service had been bankrupt by austerity.
Yeah.
So it's everywhere. And those are the sort of large scale issues. But of course, your average Greek is seen in the fact that, you know, their minimum wage has fallen way below what unions were organizing for 20 years ago. You know, we're not going to be the generation that is paid this much for minimum wage. We're way below that. So it's, I don't know, it's very all encompassing the way it has impacted life here.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm just then want to return back to, you know, the Syriza, party and their election in 2015 and the disillusionment that followed. What did not happen, and what did happen that led the party that was kind of a bit of a backlash, if I can characterize that accurately, to some of these measures, to caving a little bit to the push for privatization and austerity in a way that might make Greek voters completely just numb to the idea of political change in this way?
I think it's an issue sort of trust being broken, in that since the 70s, when Greece got out of a dictatorship and Greek democracy as we have it now began, there were two main parties that went back and forth, and the crisis came, and it was seen as the symptom of cronyism and nepotism on top of all the other issues that brought, I mean, the worldwide economic downturn. And so Syriza was this moment of hope. I mean, there were a lot of comparisons with Obama at the time of this like change and something super different for Greece, and someone that was, you know, a populist and speaking to what people needed and wanted to hear. And for this Jacobin article, I spoke to this academic, Helena Sheehan. She wrote a book called The Syriza Wave, Surging and Crashing with the Greek Left. She was a big Syriza supporter. And she explained to me that she views this disillusionment and this heartbreak on a systemic level through a more Marxist lens of Syriza was unable to maintain the promises they made because of the international banking systems and the creditors that were making certain demands, and that it wasn't just that promises were broken by individuals, but that it was this global system really trying hard to not let Syriza get a foothold in. And she makes a comparison to the way she sees that Syriza had this name and this notoriety even beyond Greece, right? There was also, you know, Podemos, the Spanish leftist party, were coming to Syriza rallies in 2015. They were seen as this sort of new leftist order in Europe, at least. And again, Sheehan argued to me that this was very scary and needed to be crushed. I think some Greeks I talk to see it that way. Some don't see it so systemically. They see the internal Greek nepotism and the way promises were made and broken in order for Syriza to remain in power, and how, of course, really beautiful rhetoric that we're going to get ourselves out of this crisis, but then at the end of the day, you're still a politician. I think a lot of these things play a part in what happened with Syriza. But I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is that they really are hard to trust and believe in. And I think even people who voted for Syriza, it wasn't with an enthusiasm or a belief that they were going to bring a change. It was more, okay, they're trying to do this pluralist leftist approach of forming coalitions. They're the best option that we have. It was always this sort of, who's my best, worst option?
Right. And that's not always the best, most effective route to actually gaining power, just to say, least, honestly. Lastly here, just to return to the New Democracy Party, and I see it described as center right. It seems pretty right wing to me. Feels like they are still poised to be in power in this second round. Is that a good read? And what does the future hold if that ends up being the case? If we still have
you.
So you just cut out briefly, but we have you back.
Okay.
Yeah.
I heard you, but I got you.
Okay.
But yeah, no, you're completely right. It's almost certain that they're going to win. I mean, it would be truly shocking to me and everyone else if they didn't. And I think I agree with your assessment of they're right, they're not center right. I mean, it's a little bit splitting hairs, but I think it reveals they're not right wing in Greece, which is a country that had self-declared Nazis in the parliament a few years ago. Okay, so maybe compared to that, they're center right. But if you look at their policies, they're quite right wing. And they have campaigned and lauded themselves in recent years as being the law and order policy, which means that they've increased and invested in the numbers of Greek police, the access Greek police have to universities and to the rest of society. And this has become a huge point of public debate. They were especially violent during the lockdown and then during demonstrations. In a country that does not have the same gun problem as the U.S., there were 2 police shootings and killings of young Roma men in last year. There's been a history of police violence for years in Greece. In the past 4 years, complaints of brutality have shot through the roof. And this is something that New Democracy really puts their stamp on, of we are going to continue to increase the police force. This is how we're going to bring law and order and normality to Greece. They also have a very right-wing, very specific anti-immigration policy. Vocally anti-immigration. They have pledged to lengthen the border fence to cover entirely Greece's land border. At one point, there was a proposal to build a fence in the sea so that migrants could not come over. And more than anything, I think what people see from Greece now is, though the government has denied it, it has been proven time and time and time again by every single journalistic outlet that Greece is illegally pushing back migrants who are trying to come seek asylum in Europe and in incredibly more violent and systemic ways. I mean, just before this last election, there was a New York Times investigation with a video of an entire pushback, which is a violation of Greek law, of European law, of the Geneva Convention. I've written pieces where I know people who have been trying to get to Greece to seek asylum have been pushed back 10 times. So this is something also that both vocally and tacitly is a real cornerstone of the New Democracy platform. And of course, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I just want to, I mean, for me, it's just, it's so important to point out how this is a part of larger right-wing movements in Europe in general. You're seeing it in Italy. That was the major platform plank there led to the rise of Meloni, and say in Sweden. I mean, we could go down the list, but we're on a little bit of a delay. I didn't mean to cut you off. Continue.
No, it's okay. Yeah, sorry for the delay. But yeah, no, it's right in keeping with the rest of Europe. And I think this is the right or central right. Mitsotakis, the prime minister, has been called one of Brussels' darlings. He's this sort of technocrat. He went to Harvard. They mention it all the time. He has this very polished way of speaking, especially in the rest of Europe. He speaks good English. And he seems as a standard neoliberal reformer. But what we see here at Greece is also just incredibly more and more right-wing crackdowns of all sorts of parts of life, be it, you know, on immigration, be it from the police force. Freedom of the press has plummeted in the past 4 years. It's now the lowest in Europe. So there's quite a few pretty standard right-wing textbook moves we see coming from the New Democracy government. And if they win the second round of elections as handedly as they won the first, they'll get this extra pillow of extra seats in the parliament. They could have a 2/3 majority in the parliament, and that could mean that they could change the constitution in Greece, which could mean all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah. Well, to be determined, I guess. Maura Lavelle, independent reporter covering Greece. You can read her piece in Jacobin and definitely her work in the coming weeks as the elections, the second round, comes around the corner. The piece is Greece's election offers little hope for an end to austerity. Maura, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Of course. All right, guys, we are going to take a quick break. Be right back. Back on the Majority Report, but this is the conclusion of the free part of this program. If you want to become a member, join themajorityreport.com. Support this show, the great interviews that we do with all these excellent guests. It really helps us out. So please, if you can, join themajorityreport.com. It is, how much is it a month? $5? Should I know this?
Damn, that's a good question.
Jeez.
$10 a month.
$10 for a membership, but you can IM us and you can support the show. So, on ESPN yesterday, since we were off on Monday, Bradley and I gave our picks in both the Stanley Cup and NBA Finals. We went through all the angles of it, looked at the odds. We also spoke about the Oakland A's basically probably moving to Las Vegas, and the DeAndre Hopkins cutting by the Arizona Cardinals, youtube.com/ESPN show. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning, we have actually this afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern Time, we're begin talking to Common Sense Skeptic about Elon Musk and Tesla. So check that out. And we'll be talking about Alberta politics for Patreons on Sunday, patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
And check out the discourse. We don't have Brandon Sutton today, but that is his show. We do, however, have Matt Binder, who has two shows for the price of one, basically, that he'd like to plug. How you doing, Matt? And what's happening on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Sure, I'm doing good. On Doomed this week, we had on Walker Bragman to talk about his report about this document he got access to that basically showed collusion between a number of online right-wing influencers and various different shady PR firms trying to sort of launder the image of Miles Guo, a Chinese billionaire who was recently arrested on a series of various money laundering and fraud charges, some related to a crypto scheme he had. He stole hundreds of millions of dollars from various people over the years, and he has various ties to right-wing figures. He was a major benefactor for the alt-right-wing social media platform Getter, and he's a good friend and longtime partner of Steve Bannon. In fact, when Steve Bannon was arrested for his own scheme, they found him hanging out on Miles Guo's yacht. And so it's certainly a very interesting episode. Check that out. It'll be up in a little bit at doomedcast.com, or you can check out the video version right now at youtube.com/Matt Binder. And new episode of Scam Economy will be coming out next week. So just hold on tight and it'll be here.
All right. Well, with all that said, we are going to head into the fun half where we will be taking your calls, reading your IMs, all of that good stuff. The number is 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dennerke.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out
out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back. Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total, 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 total